Hello, I'm Dr. Annette Rubri from the Knowledge Centre, and today I'm joined by Dr. Chris Copperwheat, who's a postdoctoral research fellow in the Astronomy and Astrophysics group at the University of Warwick. Chris came to Warwick in November 2006 after completing his PhD at the Mallard Space Science Laboratory. He's here today to talk to us about the Perseid meteor shower. Welcome, Chris, and thank you for talking to us today.
Pleasure.
We often call meteors shooting stars. If you could start by telling us what exactly a meteor is and why do we get meteor showers?
Okay, sure. Well, our solar system is full of a variety of objects. We're all familiar, of course, with the very big ones, the planets. And then going down in size, there are many rocks and sort of icy snowballs, the asteroids, the comets. But then, of course, there's a great deal of the smaller material, pebbles, things of that size, a few centimetres, dust grains, sand-sized particles. We generally refer to this as dust, and it sort of permeates the entire solar system. And so as the Earth moves on its orbit around the Sun, it sweeps up some of this material. Mm-hmm. Now, the material's travelling very fast, 20, 30 kilometres a second. The Earth is also travelling very fast. So when we sweep up this material, it's a fast impact. As the dust grain enters our atmosphere, there is a compression of the air in front of the grain. It's heated up dramatically. There's a shockwave in front of it. And so we see a trail of sort of molten material and gas behind it. And that is the shooting star, or more properly, the meteor. Mm-hmm. So these things happen commonly. And you can go on any dark night, and if you're lucky and patient, you'll see meteors. A meteor shower is when the Earth is passing through an area that is particularly dense, like there's a cloud of material. So we see a lot of meteors in a short space of time. And the other key thing about a shower is that this cloud of material, everything in that material has a common origin. So it's all moving together at roughly the same speed in the same direction. So because of the effect of perspective, as it enters our atmosphere, we see it coming from a single point, which we call the radiant point. So these trails you see in the sky, you trace them all back and they're all coming from one single point on the sky. And so that, in a nutshell, is what we call a meteor shower.
And could you tell us a little bit about the Perseid meteor shower?
Okay. Well, first of all, just about the name. There's many meteor showers, but the two are big ones that a lot of people have heard of, the Perseids and the Leonids. The Perseids we see in August, the Leonids in November. And the name of all these showers comes from where this radiant point that I mentioned earlier, the origin of all the trails. So for the Perseids, the radiant point is near the constellation Perseus, and the Leonids, it's near the constellation Leo. So let's talk about how that cloud of material originated. So for this, we have to go back to the bigger objects. I mentioned comets earlier. There are very many comets moving at great speed through the solar system. The famous one, of course, is Halley's Comet, but there are many, many more. And I think most people are familiar with what a comet looks like. You have that sort of hard lump of ice and rock and volatile materials at the front. And then that long tail behind, you know, we've all seen those beautiful pictures. And that tail is dust and gas trailing behind the comet. So as you can see, as it passes through the solar system, it's leaving behind a load of material in its wake. So this is what causes this sort of dense cloud. Effectively, what the Earth is doing, it's passing through the wake of a comet that is long since gone, but has left behind this trail of material. And it is this dense cloud of material that causes the meteor shower. We actually know the comet that caused the Perseid shower. It's the Swift-Tuttle comet, mm-hmm. which was discovered in 1862 by Lewis Swift and Horace Tuttle. And this comet comes by the Earth every 133 years. So it was seen again in 1992, but we won't see it again in our lifetime. But we do see what it's left behind on its previous visits.
I mean, you talked about this material has been out there for a long time, and presumably now we don't really need any special equipment to be able to view the Perseid meteor shower.
No, in fact, I mean, anyone who's seen a shooting star will know that if you try to track it with a telescope, they're moving so fast, you'd have no chance. So, yeah, the naked eye is the best piece of equipment. The key thing to do is to give your eye the best chance to see it. So what you're looking for is a dark sky, obviously a clear sky. Try and get to somewhere where you can see as much of the sky as possible. You can see the horizon, so maybe a field or up a hill would be ideal. And then the key thing is to get away from all lights, what we astronomers call light pollution. So street lights, car headlights, don't let a friend shine a torch in your face. And then just adjust, which takes longer than you probably think. I mean, at least a good 15 minutes to properly adjust to the dark conditions, but as much as half an hour. And the more well adjusted you are, your night vision is, that the more you'll see. You'll be able to see the fainter ones. I mean, at its peak, you should be able to see 60 per hour if you're properly adjusted to the darkness and if you've got a good night for it.
And of course, 10th of August is kind of the time when it's peaking, really. So, I mean, is there a good time in the evening to kind of look for the shower?
Well, 10th of August is good. I mean, any of the days following that, the days over the weekend, you know, might suit you better. I mean, 11th to 14th of August, these are all times when you should see a lot. In the evening, late, 11 to 12, but I'm sorry to say the absolute best time to see it is early in the morning. I know this comes as bad news to most people, but yeah, if you can get up early, before twilight, that is the absolute key time to see it. And there's two reasons for this. I mean, the first reason is that the radiant point I talked about, the origin, is higher in the sky. The main point is that in the morning, you're effectively on the front of the Earth. If you look up the sky in the morning, you're looking into the direction of the Earth's travel. So you're seeing the Earth sweeping up many more, and the impacts are going to be more violent because they're sort of head-on collisions, so they'll be brighter. So that is the key time. It's going to be sort of no later than 5 because you're getting into twilight then, but sort of 3 to 5 is the key time. I mean, I did say earlier... no telescopes, but one thing I will say is, I mean, at the moment, you can get a really good view of Venus and Jupiter in the early morning as well. So if you need another incentive to get up and you do have a telescope, then you can mix in a bit of planet spotting with your meteor shower.
So it's definitely one for early birds then.
Yeah, that's the best time. I mean, I'm not saying that you won't see any in the evening. You'll probably get a good show in the evening. So if that suits you better, then yeah, it's worth going for it. But the absolute best time is the early morning before twilight begins.
That's really interesting, thank you. And I just wanted to round up by just asking you a little bit about your own research interests. And you mentioned planet hunting. I know exoplanets is something that you're particularly interested in, so I'd be keen to hear more about that.
Well, this is obviously a key interest of all astronomers these days. It's one of the sort of strategic goals worldwide, and it's something here at Warwick we're very involved with. The guy heading up our sort of planets division in the astronomy group is Dr. Peter Wheatley, who was one of the founders of the SuperWASP consortium, which has two telescopes around the world aimed at discovering new transiting planets. So these are planets where we see the star and we see the planet move in front of the disk of the star. So we see a little dip in the brightness, and that's how we discover them. So many people are involved in this effort. At Warwick, something we're doing is actually trying to probe the atmospheres of these transiting planets. So another key Warwick interest is a fast camera called UltraCam that was developed in collaboration with the University of Sheffield. This takes very short exposure, so it's good for seeing these little dips in brightness of the star. So what we do is we have the planet, and there are clouds of material in the atmosphere of this planet, and at some wavelengths it's opaque to light, and at some it's transparent. So if you look at different wavelengths, sometimes you'll see these clouds, sometimes you won't. So if you measure the size of the planet, you measure different sizes at different wavelengths, and that way you can probe the atmosphere. So this is something there's a lot of interest in at institutes around the world, and something we're also working on here at Warwick. Currently we're looking at the big planet, the Jupiter-sized planets, but if we refine these techniques, then this is when we get the Earth-sized planets, we'll be looking for the atmospheric composition of those. So we'll be looking for water, we'll be looking for signs of organic processes. People have even said we'll look for pollution, you know.
Yeah, this is extraordinary, though.
Yeah. So this is you know, what we would hope to do in the future, you know, in the search for life, which is one of the kind of key goals of the whole planet programme.
Well, thank you so much, Chris. It's been a pleasure talking to you today. And do visit the Knowledge Centre again soon for more insights and expertise from Warwick's research community.